Okay, so we can resume again.
Yeah, I Brenda was a flight attendant, and she was my fiance at the time. As of now, she's my wife, my only wife, and wife of 43 years next month.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Wait a minute, 1970, 44 years next month. I better remember that. Anyway, we, with her flight attendant status, she was able to fly to Sydney, Australia on a pass. And I met her in Sydney, and we had R&R in November, late November. She actually missed her birthday because of the international dateline and claims she's a year younger. And had a wonderful time in Sydney. We enjoyed it. Sydney was very cheap in 1969. And we had a great time going to good restaurants. They were building the opera house. Hadn't been completed yet. Went to the Sydney Zoo. We toured. We had an absolutely great time. And I knew that when I got back, I only had less than 2 months to go. So it was good.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
By then, I was off the boats, too. I had been made maintenance officer for the division. I was still in Antoy. They had a way of rotating boats in and out of Antoy because it was a hot base. And if you did 6 months on the boats in Antoy, chances are you were going to end up being transferred to Cameron or Quignon or, you know, a little calmer type thing. And the guys that had done 6 months in Quignon and Cameron would be rotated down to Antoy. So everybody got, you know, everybody had the same shot at survival.
Did you ever visit Saigon while you were in the...
The only thing I saw in Saigon was the base, Tonsonut Air Base. I was only there twice. Two nights, one when I came from Cameron down to Antoy. And then, well, three times. When I went out on R&R, I went from Tonsonut. And when I left Vietnam, I went out on Tonsonut. I never got into town, never had a desire to go into town. As far as I was concerned, when I was on a base in Saigon, I didn't have my weapon. I was naked, and I didn't trust anybody.
Huh. That makes sense. So did you have any exposure at all to urban South Vietnam?
No. You don't want to call it urban. We spent time in the village in Cai Nuc that I told you about.
Yeah.
Very small village.
Yeah.
As urban as we got was the town of Hat Tien on the Cambodian border, and we were in and out of that town. I remember they had the only TV I ever saw in Vietnam was in the right in the center of Hat Tien, outside, so the villagers could watch their local television.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's very cool. So one of the things, movies, and you mentioned that Apocalypse Now, and you're not the first person who said that completely unrealistic point of view, and I'm sure that's the case with many, many films about the war, but one of the things, you know, as someone who didn't participate, when you watch these movies, they're often cloaked in loud rock music and drug use. So talk about music a little bit. I'm kind of interested. What kind of music were you into, and was that typical of what everybody listened to?
Probably the most of the music that I heard, other than, let's see, we had PSYOPs operations, psychological ops, where you would go down the river. We had a microphone system, cassette tape system, blaring Your Mother Wears Combat Boots and all that wonderful stuff, trying to get the enemy to come over to our side, which in our mind only draws fire.
Right.
You really tick them off and they're going to shoot at you.
Yeah.
So I had Glenn Campbell's Wichita Lineman tape. That was the selection I played for my Vietnamese friends down in the Delta. And never got shot at, so they must have liked it. Didn't get shot at when we had a PSYOPs tape, which was Glenn Campbell. Got shot at when we had a PSYOPs tape that was trying to get them to come over to our side, or the Vietnamese side. But I don't recall listening to a lot of radio. We didn't have television. We had movies.
Right.
Most of the movies we had were Clint Eastwood type movies, you know, rah-rah.
Yeah, right.
And we would do body counts. But I know that when I got became maintenance officer in the division, one of the things they had a tape library, reel-to-reel tapes.
Yeah.
And there was a great series out there at the time, and I can't remember what it was, but we would tape those, and you know, to bring home. Great, you know, all kinds of music. Nothing current. I know that one of the things in Saigon that everybody listened to was the Armed Forces Radio and Adrian Kronauer. Never heard Adrian Kronauer. I don't think we had much radio contact either.
Okay.
So we weren't really aware of what music was big.
Okay.
At home and things like that. So in terms of what they were showing, and mostly because we were an isolated base.
Right. Well, when you explain the fact
we're
that
living
on,
off ships,
right.
Or we're living off a small island.
Right. You're not going to be playing
a big island.
You're not going to be playing music loudly for your own
we're
use
not,
when you're
yeah.
on a boat like that.
We're
right?
not. Yeah. So we weren't fully aware of things that are going on back home, and that's fine. It didn't bother me a bit. You know, you get into that stuff and a lot of the things are foggy.
Yeah.
So
right.
if I was listening to loud music, I don't remember.
You don't remember it. Okay. All right. What about drug use? Did you see a lot of drug use at all?
Because we were isolated.
You didn't
see it.
Okay. Interesting.
You saw cheap alcohol over at the clubs on the base, which
right.
were nothing but a little Quonset hut.
Right.
You know, beer was cheap and liquor was cheap.
Okay. All right.
That's our celebrations were, you know, we'd come back after 2 weeks down south or something and our celebration of life was getting blitzed.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. I don't blame you. You mentioned that you were encountered both the NVA and the Viet Cong. Did you ever see any large numbers of troops, or did this just kind of pop out of the jungle?
You were probably, in most cases, facing 10 to 20 in an ambush. Usually more around 10 or 12. The typical ambush would start with possibly a waterborne mine being blown up. You'd face rocket propelled grenades. They might have a recoilless rifle, but they would have AK-47s. Always had those. So most of the time, it was RPGs. And every once in a while, they'd have a 51 caliber machine gun. Usually that would be an NVA. And they had to guess the river right, because they had to move that around.
Right.
I don't think they had many of them down there. Maybe one or two. But
so it was normally small numbers of people with lighter arms,
yeah.
more or less, that they
yeah.
carried.
The biggest force that we faced, I think, in our particular area was on the Dong Keo, April 12th. It was a big operation. Included Vietnamese Marines, 13 boats, helicopters, and it was pretty much a massacre. They set up a great ambush, cost us a boat. You know, we'll get into that when you said, have you lost any friends?
Yeah.
But that was the biggest, that was the worst.
At what point of your, was that like midway through your
well,
6 months?
Well, that was April 12th, and that was midway through my time on the boats. But
yeah,
actually, it was 2 months into the tour.
Okay.
Exactly 2 months.
So you hadn't been there a long period of time yet?
No.
You mentioned...
I wasn't in that one. I was a spare crew because I had an engine pulled out of the boat, and my boat was inoperable. It was an Antoy, and we went down there as spare crew. And that was the one day I wasn't hot bunking somebody else's boat.
Wow.
But I stood on the LST and watched that column of smoke from the 43 boat being blown up.
Wow.
And just felt helpless.
Right, Yeah. That's one of those, like your training missions that you missed for a variety of reasons, right? It was just.
And I'll go into that when we talk about losing a friend.
Yeah.
Because I was almost on his boat.
Wow.
Because he didn't. He thought he was just taking in a pallet of ammo and the UDT and the UDT team to drop him off to the other boats.
Well, you know, we don't need to go in order if you want to cover that topic.
We can
we might
talk
as well
about
do it now
that.
Since
you,
we're there.
You asked if I had lost any friends.
Yeah.
And this was a good friend. He was a Naval Academy graduate. And how can you develop a friendship like that in 2 months? It's hard to explain. But he was my first week in the rivers when I was on John Kerry's boat. He was one of the other two boats that we operated with. His name is Don Droz. He was a Lieutenant JG. He had actually just gotten back in April from R&R, where he... First time he had laid eyes on his 3-month-old daughter in Hawaii. Quality guy. And I had come off a patrol, and he ducked his head. I was writing a letter to Brenda, and Don came into the mess decks, and he said, "Hey, you want to take a ride in with me? I just got to drop off the UDT pallet of UDT explosives and the team and come back." And I said, "Geez, I'm in the middle of writing a letter." I said, "I haven't gotten a letter off to Brenda in over a week, and she's going to start to worry." I said, I got to finish this thing. I'll see you when you get back." Well, they were running late. It was a Coast Guard commander who was the new market time boss in Four Corps running the operation. His name was Yost, Commander Yost. He later became commandant of the Coast Guard. And he had never been in an operation before, but he's officer in tactical command on this one. He had Don Droz, rather than offload the ammunition and stuff, or the explosives, 1,000 pounds of explosives, and the UDT team, he had them form up with the rest of the boats and enter the river. He didn't expect to. If I had said yes, put down the letter, I would have been on the boat, and he would be in the port side pilot house door. I would be in the starboard side pilot house door. And because the boat was overloaded, it was slow, and it was taken up the rear. And when they got ambushed, his boat got hit with everything. Recoilless rifle, couple of B-40s right in the pilot house, killed him. Wounded another guy, killed the chief corpsman for the UDT team, a veteran on the fantail. Made the boat, it took out the steering in the boat, and it was going full bore. Went right up on the shore and beached, right in front of the ambush site. These are all dug in foxholes and stuff, big ones. So they're facing this whole thing, right in front of them. Yost, the commander Yost, had two boats come back through the ambush site. With him aboard, I'll give him credit for that. Had him come back to get the guys, see if they could get the boat operable again, and tow it. They got all the guys off that were uninjured. They brought the injured aboard. Number of, not only a couple dead, but a few were also hit. So they got everybody aboard and got them off the boat. And now I'm starting to hear what's going on in there. So I'm out on the deck watching, and couldn't see it, but you know where they are. And next thing you know, the boat blew up because the engines were still running, overheated, all that ammunition, all of the explosives aboard. it blew after everybody had got they had gotten everybody off, and the boat was totally destroyed.
Wow.
And you can look, you've probably seen the websites. One of them is PCF45.com. And if you can, you can look this one up in there. There's a, it's called Death of the 43. It was written by the XO, Lieutenant J.G., who was the, he was the XO of the UDT Team 13.
Yeah.
Name's Peter, he's a friend of mine. All of a sudden, I can't think of Peter's last name. He lives in Hartford.
Okay.
I'll think of it. Anyway, Peter wrote this thing for the UDT cruise book. He wrote a great article on this, Death of the 43. And it's worth reading.
Okay.
It's a very good account. And it's on that website. You can click on it on that website. It was a devastating ambush. It was something, you know, I just lost a good friend. And we had even talked about extending our service to go to ROTC school together and yeah. teach ROTC, you know, Navy ROTC. He had already gotten his orders for Dartmouth.
Wow.
And so Peter Upton.
Peter Upton, okay.
And Peter wrote a great article on it. It's worth a read. It's a good read.
When they evacuated the guys off the boat, was there a firefight going on?
Oh, yeah.
At the time?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This was all under fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's fortunate they were able to get those men off the boat before it blew, because yeah. it could have been a little
Well,
worse.
Not only... it was going to be overrun by the enemy, too. They would have taken advantage of that. I mean, they had them all pinned down. They were using the boat as cover. You know, they were off the boat, using
yeah.
it as cover. Somewhere in the water, using the stern as cover and firing into it. It was a devastating loss.
Wow.
And that night, I remember the Coastal Squadron 1 commander, call sign Latch, Captain Hoffman. He was in the helicopters that day. When the helicopters were called in, he rode in one of the helicopters. He came aboard the LST that night with Commander Yost, talking about how we could go in. We could always go in the next day and show the flag. And I'm, you know, this is not a good moment
right.
for that. And he's trying to bring the morale of the troops up. They were in. They spent the night in there. They didn't come out till the next day. You know, there had been a sweep, and of course, by then the enemy had left. But there were Vietnamese Marines in. I mean, it was a big op. And I lost a good friend.
Yeah, that's got to be tough. That's got to be tough remembering it after all this time as well.
His daughter was a filmmaker. her name is Tracy Droz Stragos. And Tracy was surfing the net one time to find out if any of her family had become famous, in her words. And she came across the Death of the 43, the story. She got into that, and she decided she was going to do a documentary, learning about her father
yeah.
and how he died. And the name of the film is "Be Good, Smile Pretty." And that's the way he ended his letters to his wife.
Oh, wow.
Her name was Judy. And hell of a documentary. It was on PBS. Really a.
Have you ever been in contact with her?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, good. Good. That's a very powerful story.
Yeah.
It's heartening to know that his, despite the tragedy, that his daughter grew up to do something like that.
She didn't know her dad.
Right.
She was 2 or 3 months old when he saw her.
Right. So that's a fun.
And it was tough on her family, because this is all, you know, a few years back, but they had to bring all the skeletons out of the closet, you know, all of the letters. His mother brought all the trunk in the attic that she had never opened, brought that down for Tracy to go through. And she interviewed all the guys that were on that mission, a lot of the guys that were on the mission that were friends of Don's, guys that had graduated from the academy. Guys I knew, you know, and very powerful.
I mean, something like that kind of reanimates him to some degree in a very laudatory fashion.
Yeah.
So that's very impressive. That's a very powerful story. Is that a documentary widely available?
I don't know if it is now. I have the DVD.
Okay, all right. It sounds like it's worth watching. So, sounds like an interesting thing.
The name of it is Be Good, Smile Pretty. And
now, what about yourself? Were you ever wounded?
Yeah. At one point, I think we had more Purple Hearts in the division than we had boat crews.
Really?
Yeah. It was that active. The Operation Sea Lords, which began in October of 68, late October 68, involved swift boats, PBRs, some of the Mobile Riverine Force, and the Coast Guard WPBs. Casualty rate in Sea Lords was the highest of any naval unit in country. It was running at 6% a month at that time, which means if you did a year on a boat, you had a 70 to 75% chance of either dying or being wounded.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was very active. And you pretty, like I said, you're in the rivers, you have no cover. So when it hits the fan, you know, you might as well stand out there in that doorway, because there's nowhere to hide. At least you can see what's going on and direct your fire and direct the boats. So
What were most injuries from direct hits or from shrapnel or what?
Shrapnel was a lot of it because of the RPGs. One of the good things about an aluminum boat is sometimes they can pass through without exploding.
Okay.
But most of the times it would explode. You'd get pieces of wire and shrapnel from the round itself, which was a shape charge, or the aluminum was flying, you'd get pieces of aluminum stuck in you. There had been direct hits with B-40 rockets.
Did you want to pause here? Yeah.